Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffy Kennedy, author of Fantasy and Romance and All of the Perfect Places They Intersect. I am here not with my first cup of coffee today because I have a special celebrity guest from the other side of the world. Please welcome Nalini Singh.
Hi.
Hello,
Hi.
Nalini.
It's good to be here.
It's lovely. We had a little bit of trouble coordinating time zones for no good reason. But it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon for me, and it is late morning
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, it is.
All right. So a very important part of the First Cup of Coffee podcast is to inquire, are you drinking coffee? Are you past
I'm
that
actually
now?
Drinking cocoa.
Like hot,
hot
or cold?
Hot. I'm not a big fan of like cold. Well, I suppose deep in summer, I would be drinking like hot or cold chocolate. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, hot cocoa today. Usually it would be tea.
So why the change?
It's a little
today?
Bit cooler. So we're in spring at the moment, and it's a day that's like it's going to rain soon, it looks like, and it's a nice atmosphere for cocoa, I think.
Yes, for sure, for sure. And so you are celebrating a release. Is it this week?
Yeah, so in New Zealand, it's today because we live in the future. And
right.
It's the 24th is the release of Archangel's Son.
So today is a very busy day.
Yeah,
for you.
A little bit. Actually, it was yesterday I did some, signed some stock for a local bookseller. And then, today I'll do my newsletter and things like that. But it'll probably be busier tomorrow because that's when it really is released, you know, in a lot more territories.
Right, right. In the rest of the world. And so what is this book?
It's Archangel's Son. So it's part of the Guild Hunter series. And it features two characters who have been mentioned throughout the series. So the Archangel Titus and a character called Shireen. She's also known as the Hummingbird. And they've both been mentioned throughout the series, but we haven't really got to know them. In a significant way. We've just gotten to see them through the eyes of others. And, Titus, he's this big, brash presence, and Shireen is the opposite in many ways. A lot of what we've seen of her has been someone quite broken, and she's gradually sort of come out of this fog in which she has been living in for a very long period of time because these are immortals. So there's a lot in her past that sort of sent her into this really, she calls it like a broken kaleidoscope. That was her mind. And so when these two come together, you know, it's going to be really unexpected because Titus, you know, he's sort of expecting this broken bird and he's like, oh gosh, I better not talk too loud. You know, I might scare her kind of thing. And meanwhile, Shireen is coming into herself. She is, you know, she's found her wings again, and she is not at all what he's expecting. So there's a lot of fireworks. There's a lot of humor. It's a fun book, actually, even though it's quite dark because it's the aftermath of this archangelic war. So a lot of terrible things happen. But because of the chemistry between these two, it's just a really good book, I think. To fall into and get to know these two. And I'll just mention one other thing. I think if someone hasn't read the series at all, they can technically read this book on its own because these two characters are, this book takes place in a different part of the world. And even though it's part of the main storyline, because it's the story of these two characters who haven't, you know, had a major role in previous books, we can really, you know, you can dive in because you get to know them in this book. of course, you will be spoiled for the rest of the series previously. But if you really do want to try this one, you can. You will understand it.
So now when you say that she's a hummingbird, does she become a literal hummingbird?
No, she's an angel. So he's an archangel and she's an angel, a normal angel. She's called a hummingbird for other reasons, which are explained in the book. And she's also an artist, and so she's become known as, you know, the hummingbird, and it's all related to her art. But in this book, we really get to find out where exactly that nickname came from.
It's funny because in some of my books, I have a shapeshifter who becomes a hummingbird.
I want to know, how do you explain the the mass differential?
Conservation of mass. Yes. So in my books, I decided to throw out conservation of mass. Because with shapeshifters anyway, I mean, we're already moving into something that's implausible biologically. And I'm a biologist by training, so it's like, you know, even when people go into the intricacies of like which blood vessels match where, it's like, you know, really, it's just not going to work. So it's magic, right? And I figured, you know, why would you cling to conservation of mass if you're going to allow other things? So my shapeshifters sometimes liken it to like almost like they're swapping bodies that are in a different space and bringing them back.
That's interesting. That's a really cool way to think about it. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. Because you have shapeshifters in your
I do.
Right?
And so mine sort of go into another form. You know, they turn into light, basically, and then transform into whether the animal or back into the human form. So that's how I deal with it, that transition into light, and then they can become anything else, you know, on the other side, whatever their shape-shifting ability is. So, yeah, we do.
So, actually, ours are
not
that different.
So I think it depends how you write shapeshifters. Like, if you write the real old school where, you know, like the old movies where they're literally, their bones are coming out and...
Yes, and there's blood and goo.
That's different. I think there you do have to think about mass a bit more because... you can literally see someone's bones shifting into this other shape. Whereas I think how we write it, there's more freedom for different sizes of shapeshifters.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And it's less disgusting. You know, like, did you ever read Laurel K. Hamilton's
books? I did.
I was
a huge, huge fan when I think I started reading them when I would have been quite young, maybe university. I'm not sure, but yeah. I know what you mean with it.
Yeah, because I love those books too. Anita Blake to start out with, but then there's like that one pivotal scene where like Richard shapeshifts on top of her, and she's like totally drenched.
Yeah, so I mean, she did it well because I was still into them as a couple and, you know, all the shapeshifters and stuff. It's very different. Yeah, stylistically, it's just a different style. And I just find it interesting how different authors deal with shapeshifting.
Yeah, for sure. Now you have to tell me, were you Team Richard or Team Jean-Claude or...
Ooh, you know what? Maybe I'll just leave you in suspense with that one.
Oh, you're not going to
commit? I'm not going to commit. That was the problem. I couldn't commit in the books either. I was just like, because, you know, they both had their good points. And it was kind of like the Buffy Spike Angel thing where it's like.
Are you not going to commit on
that
one?
Well, actually, I probably fall on the Spike side there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We can be friends. I'm definitely Team Spike.
I mean, at first I wasn't, you know, in the beginning, but I just thought his character was so well written through the series.
It was a great transformation.
It was. And also, it matched her transformation. So, like, Angel was right for her when when she kind of was one person, but then she became sort of a different person.
I loved that Spike was really the only one who understood what it was like for her having been dead and come back to life.
Yes, I think that was critical because it's such a massive alteration in her life. Of course, it's going to change you as a person.
Yeah, all right. So Team Spike, and I'm just Team Jean-Claude from way back.
I remember waiting for that scene between the two of them, Anita and Jean-Claude. That is a very pivotal scene. So I guess.
And we had to wait for like 6 or 7
books.
So many books.
So I guess I have to say Jean-Claude just because I so vividly remember that scene, because that's one of the most, probably, you know, that stuck with me. That's one of the most strongest scenes in the series that stuck with me. Yeah.
Yeah, now you have me jonesing for a reread.
I was thinking
that
about that too. I was like, it's been a long time since I reread those.
Yeah, for sure. And very interesting that we were both so influenced by that. I mean, when reading those Anita Blake books, that was unlike anything else at the time.
I think for me, it was, I think probably my bigger influences actually came out of old science fiction and fantasy.
Like
I'm trying to think, like, Anne McCaffrey is a big one. I was reading her as a young teen, and it was the, because it wasn't specifically the shape-shifting, it was the world-building. Like, she was the first author I read where it was this, she built this massive world, and it felt very real. Like, there were these corners of it you could go into, and I really, I have to admit, I'm not a writer who breaks down stuff, so I don't sort of sit down with a book and say, hey, how did this author do this, and try and figure it out, like nuts and bolts. I'm more of an instinctive reader, and I think I also learn like that. So for me, just being in that world, I was learning how she was doing it, even though I didn't want to write, you know, what she was writing, the similar type of thing. You know, I was wanting to write different things. But what I learned was how to build this really cohesive world that, like, if you look behind the curtain, what's behind the curtain is what's supposed to be there, if you know what I mean. Like, there's no blank space. And you can imagine beyond this moment and the scene you're in. So, and I read a ton of other, and the names escaped me because I read, just absorbed them as a teenager, but I read some very, very dark, I guess there's dark fantasy, and I think that had an influence as well. Just in terms of creating these really, really dark worlds. And that obviously comes through later in my Guild Hunter series, you know, with the darkness of that series. But, and also I was influenced by, obviously, romance authors, because I have a feeling that I was already writing my first paranormals when I found the Anita Blake series. That's why I'm saying it's not really an influence book, but more of a book that really spoke to my interests that had already developed at that time, and just finding someone who was doing it so, so well. And she was a real, I think at that time she was, what she was doing, I don't think anybody else was really doing that in terms of urban fantasy.
I think that's right.
It's interesting. I mean, I've read all those sort of canon authors, I think, Christine Feehan, of course, is a big one for me, because she was one of the first authors I read who was actually doing what I really wanted to read, which was a really strong mix of science fiction, fantasy type world building, but also romance. heavy romance. And so, and then there was Sherilyn Kenyon, you know, all those authors that were right at the forefront. But yeah, huge influence with science fiction and fantasy as well, because as a teenager, I basically read those and I read romance novels. Like that was my genres of choice. And I just kind of wanted to mash them all together, which is what I did in the end. Yeah.
Right, right. So did you always want to be a writer? Was that your plan from the beginning?
I did always want to be a writer from quite a young age, but I didn't know you could do it as a living. And and so I was born in Fiji, and it's a tiny dot of an island in the Pacific. And I grew up in New Zealand, and really the only writers I ever heard about were sort of literary fiction writers that we studied in school, in terms of local authors.
Right.
And as far as I knew, none of those local authors was, you know, doing it as a living. And I think the only one I ever met who did it as a living was a children's author that I met in primary school, who did a talk at our school. But there was really no awareness of genre authors, or local genre authors especially. And so I always thought it would be like a hobby, or like something I pursued outside of another career. And I actually don't think that was a terrible thing to think, because we both know that writing, nothing is guaranteed as a writer. I think we'd agree. And yeah.
Yes.
So...
We
all wish for that huge deal, you know, suddenly you're like, oh, we're going to give you all the money and for your first book. But of course, that's not how it happens, you know. And I think I had quite a practical mindset, just because that's how I grew up, thinking that it was going to be something I had to pursue outside other work. So I didn't put this massive pressure on myself to kind of get like a huge deal and just to be a writer. You know, I worked through university, and then I worked, you know, I got a job outside university, and I was always writing. But because I didn't have the financial pressure of having to support myself with my writing straight away, I think it gave me the freedom to develop as a writer. It gave me a sort of put a good head on my shoulders kind of thing. So even when I decided I did want to go full time as a writer, I just had very sort of practical goals. I just wanted to be able to literally, you know, pay my rent, buy my food, pay my bills kind of thing, like very just a very basic level of income. I had figured out how much I needed to earn as a writer to be able to do this. And so anything that happened beyond that was just like this joyful surprise, and it was wonderful. But it meant, yeah, that I had a lot of freedom in terms of how I wrote, because I was like, okay, this is the goal. You can reach that goalpost, I think, with where I was in my writing career at that point. But at the same time, I always had the backup career. So I could always go back and get a real job. I'm saying that in air quotes, because that's how everyone always puts it, you know.
Right.
So I think one thing I will say is actually meeting some genre fiction writers from New Zealand who were very successful overseas was a big turning point for me. I met them at my first Romance Writers of New Zealand conference, and I was at university at the time, and my mom had actually paid for me to attend the conference as a birthday present after I saw saw a write-up in the newspaper, like the local newspaper, and she knew how much I wanted to write. And that's what I wanted to do. So I went, and I met Robin Donald, Daphne Clear, and Susan Napier, who, huge writers for Harlequin, Mills and Boone, like millions of copies sold. And I had never known they were New Zealanders. I had read their books. And so it was just, I think being able to see someone else having achieved the dream helps to know that it's possible. Yeah.
Yes. Makes it real. So then what did you do? Did you start querying agents?
Yeah. It's a bit notorious, the story among my friends. I sent off my first submission to, and it was Harlequin I sent it to, because at the time Harlequin was one of the only publishers taking queries from outside the territory in which they were based. So I was sending queries to London, and the first one I sent, I did it when I was 18, because I was like, of course they're going to love my book. It's brilliant, you know, because I was a teenager, you know. and I actually never stopped after that, because even though I was rejected quite smartly, I already was working on something else. And I was like, well, I'll just send them this one, and it'll be even better. And the funny thing is, my first sale actually ended up being to Silhouette in New York. So I never did sell to Mills and Boone in London. But, you know, it was all steps that led me to that eventual sale.
So your first publication was Silhouette.
Yeah. So I wrote, I sold in 2002 to Silhouette, and I wrote, overall, I wrote 6 books for them. And, but in between,
as Melanie Singh,
you can still find them. Online, and they reissue them every so often with new covers, but these are not new books. These are just those 6 books that I wrote back at the start of my career. And I think if anybody's curious to read them, they should, and just be aware this is me. So that's almost 18 years ago. It's like, 18 years ago for the first book. So you just have to read with the awareness that this is me starting out in my career. I mean, I still love those books, because that, particularly Desert Warrior, which was my first book, because it was my first book, you know, that was my first ever published book. And I just have such powerful feelings for it, just because I remember what it was like to hold my first book. And this is the time before ebooks. So I was literally holding, you know, the printed book, everything was in print. And all the others, you know, that was who I was at that point in my career, in my writing life. And I know sometimes authors say they don't want to read their previous stuff, but I'm fine with it, because I for me, the memories are linked to who I was as a writer at that point in time.
I totally get that.
Do you read your own stuff that you've previously written?
I do. I haven't read some of the super early stuff, but I do revisit things occasionally. And it's interesting to see how I've changed.
Oh, for sure. And I think also, because you write series as well, and I feel like as a series writer, you have to maintain the continuity of the series.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it's and then it is kind of a treat to go back, and I get drawn into my own books, which I can never decide if that's bad, but it's like I enjoy the story.
It's true, I do this too, because the thing is, I think it's good, because I started writing some of this because I couldn't find what I wanted to read, like exactly what I wanted to read. So I just started writing it. So I think I should be my first fan, so to speak. So, I think we should be happy to enjoy our work.
I love that. So you wrote these 6 Silhouettes, and which is a pretty straightforward category romance. There's not a blueprint, but they are very particular styles of stories. And then you branched out into this more paranormal thing.
Yeah, so it wasn't quite a straight line just because there's an overlap. So my first Paranormal came out in 2006, which is only 3 years after my first category, romance, my first Silhouette Desire. But the thing was, I actually always was writing speculative fiction, so science fiction, fantasy, paranormal, while I was writing the contemporary stuff. And while I loved the Silhouette Desire line and I loved reading those stories because they're, you know, they're short category romances and done well, they're just so beautifully emotional. But I didn't quite fit. I didn't quite fit, and I was having real trouble selling to them. So I have a lot of friends who write category romance, and they were selling sort of like 4 books a year to the publisher. Meanwhile, I could barely get, one through. And I just wasn't the right fit. And I tried my hardest because I had a lot of emotional connection to category romance because they were some of the first romances I grew up reading. I shared them, with my aunts, and I just really wanted to be published by them. But looking back, I can see that, my tendency is more towards, the paranormal romance, the science fiction, and then that kind of end of things. And even when I go back to, I have gone back and written contemporary romances again, but even there I tend to build sort of big families and like lots of interconnected storylines, which doesn't necessarily fit with category romance. So it was a good place to start for me because, like I said, it was very difficult from New Zealand to get published with one of the big publishers. I think Harlequin was really the only one that was accepting sort of unagented submissions. So it was, it was a good way to start. And I don't have any regrets about starting that way. I enjoyed, writing these books and getting the experience as a baby writer, being part of that team, because the other Harlequin writers and Silhouette writers were so lovely to me, and made some really good friends. I really felt like I hit my stride with Slave to Sensation, which was my first paranormal.
And so what did you do on that one? Did you talk to your editor at Harlequin and say, hey, I'm trying this thing? Or did you start querying agents? You probably didn't have an agent because you didn't need one to do the categories.
Yeah, so they have very strict sort of boilerplate contracts anyway. They rarely change anything. So having an agent at that point wasn't really a priority. But I actually didn't tell anybody. I just I was actually in a really bad space because I was having so much trouble selling to Harlequin, and I had gone to Japan, and I was working over there because I think this is not a thing in the US, but in Australia and New Zealand, most people do an OE, which is an overseas experience. That's what it stands for. And a lot of people do it. So in the UK, I think they call it the gap year. So between high school and university, a lot of people do it. So they'll take a year, they'll go traveling, they'll work in another country. Or some people take it directly after university. So they've done all their studies, they're set up to get a job, but they don't want to do it straight away, so they take a year off and do that. So I did it a bit unusually. I worked actually for 2 years because as a lawyer I needed to get admitted to the bar. So I decided to do that. I didn't want a break in between because I was like, if I have a break, I'm currently in the study headspace, I can just keep going. And so how you get admitted into the bar in New Zealand is you have to be working. So it's got to be work experience. And then there's like this other course So I was working and then I left to, so then I decided, okay, I never did my OE. I really want to write. I think this is the time to go. So 2 years after, so I was in Japan, I was working on the JET program, which takes graduates from around the world. And I got to the point, I think I would have been in my second or third year. So I was only in Japan for 3 years. And I was like, I have to go back. I have to go back and get a law job because I just cannot sell enough books.
I'm a failure as a writer, and now I'm just
putting... You've got it. I mean, I literally was... I remember sitting on the tatami mat in my little apartment in my beautiful little town and just crying because I was like, you know, like, I was like, my writing dream is like in its dying kind of thing. And I decided to...
I feel you. I've been there.
Where it's just... Everything's just crashing down and it's, it was hard. But then the writing comes from within for me. I would always write, even if I wasn't publishing. And so I decided to just write this weird story I had in my head. So I wrote it. I wrote all of Slave to Sensation. And I've told the story before, I wrote it sort of manically in a 3 week period after and around work. It came out, like the whole thing came out because I think I'd been thinking about the ideas for so long and it was actually a really good draft. Usually my drafts are like, it's just me sort of blurting out the story. And then there's a lot of work, you know, to shape it into something that other people can actually understand. This book, it came out in a really good shape. And then I realized I needed an agent. So that's when I went agent hunting. Yeah.
And you queried this particular book and did you land an agent with it?
Yeah, it was quite a funny story. I had queried... I had a very short list, so I wasn't doing like a heap of queries at the same time. I think I was only doing two or three at once. And I queried the Knight Agency because they were representing, you know, they were selling to publishers that I was really interested in. And I got a response back almost straight away because the head of the agency remembered meeting me in New York. Which was my very first American conference that I ever went to. And she only remembered me because she also knows someone with the name Nalini, which was super like, you know. But, I mean, that was just a little – that was just some – you know, she just responded to that. But I sold – you know, I got the agent on the strength of the work because – she looked at the query and she actually forwarded it to another agent in the agency, Nephilee, who she thought would be a good fit. And we talked. She really liked the material because that's, you know, with agents, that's what it comes down to. It comes down to the material and what they feel about it. Yeah, so Nephilee was really enthusiastic about it and I felt good. You know, like with our communication, which is so important with an agent. And so that's how I got my agent. And
And did she sell the book right away?
It sold pretty quickly. It actually sold at auction. So, it was nice after I was crying on my tatami mat, you know, a few months earlier.
Right.
You know, that was like, I remember. I had one of those old, you know, brick cell phones and I remember making a call from Japan to New Zealand to tell my mom that I sold this book at auction. It was so exciting. And my career really sort of took off, you know, sort of.
And for those who don't know, just for the listeners who aren't familiar, auctions when several different publishers all want to buy the book and they keep raising the price in order to be the one who wins.
Yeah, it's funny when Niffley first said, oh, I think it's going to go to auction. And mine was not a huge auction by auction standards. It was a smaller one. But, you know, more than one person wanted it, which was enough for me. And
yes.
Yeah, but I remember asking her, like, how does it work? Is there an auctioneer? And she's like, no.
No.
I had no idea. It's all very civilized. They just email offers and back and forth, and the agent kind of tells other people. And, yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Yours isn't the high bid, just saying.
Yeah.
And so then, was that book, when it came out, like an instant success? Did you feel like you had hit the big time?
No, actually, Slave to Sensation didn't really hit any bestseller lists. And I think it might have hit some specific bookstore lists. But like, it didn't hit like the USA Today or the New York Times or the Publishers Weekly, you know, that kind of thing. And it wasn't but it started to gain traction with bloggers. And a lot of bloggers really supported me when I started out, which is why I'm still so super supportive of reviewers and bloggers, because, you know, they really got behind me, even though it wasn't like a big bestseller or anything like that. It wasn't actually until book four in the series that I hit my first major bestseller list. And that was a crazy day, because I, at that time, had no idea that the New York Times list came out on Wednesdays in the US. So for me, it's Wednesday afternoon, late afternoon. So for me, it's Thursday morning. And I think I'd gone out for coffee with my mom and my sister to kind of, you know, just celebrate that I'd had a book release and that kind of thing. And I came back to all these messages saying, you need to check your email. You need to call us back. it hit the extended New York Times list, and that was the first major list. And it took, you know, it took four books, 2 years in that series. So I think these days people sometimes get disheartened if they don't hit bestseller list straight away, kind of thing. But if you think about it, it was my 10th book. Book 10 since I started publishing. Nobody expected that. So that was pretty awesome. That was great.
And you are still writing that series.
I will be writing that series till I drop dead over my keyboard, probably.
If only because your readers would kill you.
Yeah, a little bit. But the thing with this world is it's so huge. It's so expansive. There's so much of it I want to explore. And there's so many different groups of characters. There's a lot of room for growth. So technically, I am writing season two of the series. So books 1 to 15 complete a story arc. And then I begin season two, which is a different story arc. So again, if someone doesn't want to read, you know, 18 books, they can start with the start of season one, which is Silver Silence. You know, you'd be fine. I've had people who jump in at that book and they've been fine. So, I like writing in seasons because I feel like I want to have a resolution of some kind.
That's a great way to put it. I hadn't heard another writer to put it that way, but that's
perfect. I think especially if you write long series, just structuring it that way for me feels like there's like peaks and valleys. So you get the climax and then you develop to the next climax and then to the next one. And it feels more satisfying as a writer and as a reader. Just to have those conclusion points along the way.
Yeah. In fact, I may have to blatantly steal that from you, because in my series, back to my favorite subject, me and my work, I just started kind of like a reboot, and I was calling it The Next Generation because it's like the kids of the original series. But I love the idea of calling it like season two, because that's
I mean, you can steal it because I stole it off television, you know, season one, season two. Right. I specifically took it off as so you're a fantasy spec fic person, so you're probably familiar with Babylon 5. Have you? Yeah.
Right.
So that's a really well written. So the first four seasons are really well written because at the end of the fourth season, they got told there would be no fifth season, so they had to crush season five into the end of season four. But before, and you can see it, and then they got told, oh, yeah, sorry, Soz, you are getting a season five. So so I don't hold that against them at all. But it's just really well written in terms of each season telling us something and then moving us into the next season. So each, the next arc. And I think another good series that wrote a really good first season was Heroes, which was on TV, which had a very significant, you know, it was a strong arc. They had a beginning, they had a middle, they had an end. So, but then there was opening for the next part of the story to happen. And that's how I like to write as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it. Now, your Psy Changelings book, season one, rather famously had an ongoing mystery that shaped that whole arc. Now, did you know from book one that that was going to be the mystery that will take you 15 books to explain?
No, not so much. So how I work is like I know when I – so when I begin a series, I ask a question So the question for the Psy Changelings series is, what if you had enormous psychic abilities? What if those psychic abilities drove you insane? What would you do to survive? And so the Psy race makes the choice of taking emotion out of their lives and becoming unemotionless and doing everything with logic. And so that is basically the question of the series at the beginning. And then I have to think of the answer. Like, where is this choice going to take them? Is this is this choice going to survive? You know, in very basic terms. And so once I know the beginning and the ending of a series, I let the characters guide me in terms of the details, because the way my brain works is if I know the ending, I instinctively seem to put the pieces in place along the way, because I always know what the end goal is. Where am I heading? And so I knew as soon as that character appeared. So it's the ghost. There was the unknown character. As soon as the ghost appeared on the page, I knew, of course, their identity, because I had to know the identity. That's the only way it works, because if you go back and reread the series from book one to book 15, the ghost is never in two places at the same time, because I am obsessive about that and I worked out time zones. So it would just, you know, they are never in two places at the same time, because to write a mystery like that only works if it works backwards. So go back and reread it and it still works. So, again, I had a question, which was, here's the ghost. The answer, of course, is what's the ghost's identity? And, again, I knew the answer at the beginning. So I hope I'm explaining it right. Like, because I know the answer. Yeah. So that's how it all hangs together. I always answer my question if I'm doing any kind of a long-running plot line. I answer the question at the start so that everything else links up through the series.
But you are not a pre-plotter on the individual books,
no.
Right? Because I think we're alike that way.
I think, I don't know how you find it, but I did try pre-plotting a book once, and it was just this horrible failure because I was so bored. I far prefer just writing my way into the story because I feel like I'm getting to know the characters, the plot line, and, yeah, telling myself a story. Yeah, I don't know. Is that the same for you, or how do you do it?
I'm just not capable of it. I can't figure out what the plot's going to be until I write it.
Yeah, I mean.
So that's why I'm fascinated that you know the answer to the question, because I never know how my books are.
Yeah, going like out. I know the answer to the major questions. So not necessarily how the plot of this particular book is going to run, but I know where it fits into the larger scheme of things. But it's all in my head. Like I don't have like this massive spreadsheet or anything. So I describe it as like a continuously running movie in my head, and we're dipping in and out at different books at different viewpoints. So yeah, it's interesting, but yeah.
I like that. So what's your question for season two?
But it's basically, I'll try not to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read the Sci Changing series, is where we end up at the end of season one. Originally, when I started the series, I thought, oh, that will be the end because we're going to have this answer. And then I got to the end and I was like, oh, okay, it's a mess now. So how's this going to work? Basically, I broke the structure of a world and it had to be broken. It wasn't working. But then you can't leave the brick.
Right. It was a dysfunctional world, right? A lot of people were miserable.
But the thing is, once you break something, what comes next? You can't just leave everything sort of in that state. You know, there has to be a what next. You know, where do they go from this point where everything that they thought was the right way has been proven to not be the right way? It's actually not working. And so we begin again. And the same question still haunts them because Sai still have enormous psychic abilities and they do still go insane. And there are all these consequences to their great power. But now they know that silence, you know, doesn't work, which is the unemotional choice they made. So it's kind of like the next stage of the world. Yeah, and where do they go from this point? There is another question hidden within there, but I won't articulate that because that's like a series point, so for people to figure out as we go along. But that's like the basic one.
Okay, all right. Well, and I won't push you, even though I was asked by listeners to find out spoilers from you, but you know. So we've been talking about Sci Changeling. The first book of yours I read, however, was in your other series, The Archangels. So when did you start writing that series?
I'm trying to think back. I feel like I want to say 2007 or 2008, maybe 2009.
So almost at the same time when you started Sci Changeling.
I think I had written at least four books, maybe five or six. It's been a while. I think it's been at least 10 years with that series, I think. I decided to, so at the start, I was writing two Sci Changeling books a year, and I had stopped writing the category romances for Silhouette, so I was only writing the Sci Changeling books. And I was at a point when I started the Guild Hunters, I was actually starting to go full-time as a writer. Not quite, because I still was doing some part-time work because I'm super conservative financially. And so I was like, I don't know if I can take the plunge yet, you know, just rely on my writing income. But a result of all this was I had more time on my hands. And part of that was because I had quite a high-pressure study schedule when I was at university. And then I was working, you know, as a junior lawyer in a law firm. So I had very little time to write. So I got very good at writing in compact bursts. So if I only had 30 minutes after work before I crashed, you know, I was writing. I was writing for those 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And that actually transferred into a very good skill when I had more time because it was quite efficient at, you know, getting my words down kind of thing, which mean I had more time to write. So I thought, oh, I'm already writing this one series. Why don't I try and write some single title stuff? So literally not series, just like one-offs. But it turns out that I am a compulsive series writer. So that's how you ended up with the Guild Hunter series. The inspiration for that particular series was that I'd read a lot of not necessarily angel books, but just books with immortals. So even vampires, you know, anything that was an immortal character. And I just felt like nobody, like I felt like they acted too human. And these are specifically in sort of romance-y types books or romance adjacent books. I felt like they were too human in how they fell in love, even.
Yes.
Yeah. So I wanted to write like a really inhuman immortal. So I wanted to write people who were just like, oh, well, humans are like ants. They're here and gone. Why do we care? Kind of thing. So, yeah.
Right. Well, very cool. So how many books are in the I always get the series title wrong. I'm sorry.
So Guild Archangel Hunter. Sun, the one that's just coming out, is book 13.
Book 13?
Of my one-off book that I was going to write. So.
Yes. So are any of your books organized into trilogies? It sounds like not.
No. That would be really, really excellent way to do it. But one of my favorite writers actually does it that way, which is Mercedes Lackey, if you've read her Voldemort. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Voldemort. I actually have all of Mercedes Lackey's books on my shelf across from me next to Anne McCaffrey's books.
Yeah, like they're legends, you know. And she's so clever in how she does it with the trilogies because you can dive in at any point. But the way I write, it just doesn't work because I have these arcs that continue. They continue in a linear way as opposed to having trilogies where you have one quest or question, it's concluded, and then you can sort of dive in at any point, which does make it a little bit more difficult, I think, for me as a writer to get new readers on board because they might look at a series that's really long and say, yeah, I don't know about that. But then that's how I write, so I just have to go with it. And which is why I make it a point to point out to readers there are points in the series you can jump in, like with Archangel Sun. You can jump in. Or if someone really wants to try something shorter from me, just wants to get a taste of my style, not necessarily paranormal or urban fantasy, I would direct them towards my contemporaries. My newer contemporaries. So I wrote a series with rock stars, and I'm writing a series with rugby players. And those all stand alone. They're connected by family members or friends. So you can pick any of those up at any point.
And are you self-publishing those?
Yeah, those are self-published.
And why'd you make the choice to go self-publishing on
those? Because I'm quite a ticky type person and I just really wanted to do it and just like have that experience to know because it's such a big part of our industry. I think you would agree. It's a big change.
I'm solidly hybrid. I'm solidly half.
Yeah, I thought you were hybrid. And so technically I'm hybrid as well, even though I have more traditional publishing. But I really felt it was important to know that part of the publishing landscape so that I do know what the options are out there and I do know what suits me. And also I felt like with the contemporaries, with self-publishing, I felt the contemporary market is also there. In ebooks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just honestly it was me just I want to try this, I want to see how it works. And I'm still self-publishing the contemporaries. I do like having that sort of hybrid aspect to my career, so
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to get the money coming in monthly for the
So it definitely sort of evens out the income throughout the year, because you know that money comes in monthly, and then the publisher money comes in twice a year. And it's, you know, and then there's the other aspect, which is foreign rights. And so that income comes in at different times in the year. So then it over the, I always tell other writers, especially ones who are starting out or who are making forks in the road, that try and put different eggs in your basket so that if one thing falls over, there's something else that will support you as you keep going in your career. So and it's fun. I like having self-publishing just as a way to try different stuff.
Yeah, it lets you sort of fill in those gaps on the traditional schedule.
So I make the schedule for the self-publishing, so I can, you know, there's no pressure of a deadline. I give myself deadlines, so yes. it's just different.
Yes, well, we're just about at an hour here, so I won't take up more of your time on release day, but big congratulations on the new release.
Thank you. I'm very excited about it. And I was going to say both covers.
Tell everyone the name of it again.
Archangel's Son. And I will say, just go and look at both covers, both the American cover and the international cover. They're both so different, and they are both beautiful. So I love them both. They're just, if I was the book buyer, I would probably be collecting those, like both of them, just because I love them so much. Both of them, they're so different. So I just paid like a ridiculous amount of money to get a signed copy of one of my favorite authors. So I am a total, you know, bookphile who will collect, you know, pretty books.
Well, that's good, because so are all of your readers,
well,
right?
Yeah.
All righty. Well, I'm going to remind the listeners that First Cup of Coffee is part of the Frolic Media Podcast Network, and you will find more podcasts you love at frolic.media/podcasts. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Jiffy. This was really fun.
It was super fun. We'll do it again sometime.
For sure.
All righty. Sure. You all take care. Bye-bye.